Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
Hi, my name is...
What?
My name is...
What?
My name is...
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
My name is...
What?
Excuse me.
My name is...
Can I have the attention of the class for 1 second?
His name is what? Slim Shady, or Marshall Mathers, depending on who's asking, but he's most widely known as Eminem, the Detroit rapper who skyrocketed to fame after the release of his album, the Slim Shady LP, which turned 20 this week. The record was plastered with a parental advisory warning and was accused of glorifying drugs and violence and especially misogyny, but the fans of Eminem and his critics also saw brilliance in the album, a showcase of the wit and lyrical mastery of a brand new rapper. Well, 20 years later, Eminem's career has been riddled with controversy, but his influence as a rapper is undeniable. So this hour on Point, we ask, does the Slim Shady still stand up? And you can join us. How do you hear the Slim Shady 20 years later? Are you an Eminem fan, or does his music still make your stomach turn? And how did Eminem change rap? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And by the way, we should note that before we go any further, we will be playing some of Eminem's songs. They are going to be the clean versions of the songs off the LP, but nevertheless, some listeners might find the content a little bit disturbing. Well, let's go to Detroit, Michigan, where we're joined by Brian McCollum. He's music writer and critic for the Detroit Free Press, where he's covered music for more than 2 decades. He wrote an oral history of the Slim Shady LP, and we have a link to that at onpointradio.org. Brian McCollum, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Okay, so first of all, just tell me, 20 years later, does the Slim Shady LP, does it still stand up?
In certain respects, it does. It certainly sounds like the late 90s, and I think most anyone would agree, any Eminem fan would agree, that he certainly went on to create bigger and better stuff, more substantive work in the years that followed. But you know, as a fun piece of kind of crossover hip-hop pop music, it's a nostalgia ride, and I still get a kick out of diving back into it once in a while.
Well, and you know, for better or for worse, it is the LP that put him on the map for so many people. But take us back to the earliest days. I mean, even before 1999, when's the first time you saw him?
I met Eminem, Marshall Mathers, in summer of 1997 at a dingy East Side Detroit club, where it was one of these countless local rap showcases that were always going on. Unlike the scenes that you would later see in 8 Mile with these packed halls, you know, full of these avid fans, it was mostly just other rappers waiting for their turn on stage.
Okay.
And that's how these things usually went. But anyway, my first impression of him was similar to what you hear a lot of people say when they meet him in a personal setting: polite, kind of intense. Some people use the word shy. That might be a bit of a stretch, but definitely the image I always remember was the lack of eye contact. So I can definitely tell you that if anyone in 1997 was prescient enough to know that 5 years later this guy was going to be arguably the biggest star in the globe, it definitely wasn't me.
Okay, fair enough. I appreciate your candor about that. But so maybe he didn't give off the affect of a soon-to-be superstar. But what did you see in terms of his talent on stage?
Yeah, I mean, I think at that point his actual sheer rapping skill was had definitely come to the fore. He had found his voice artistically. So that part of it wasn't an issue at all. I think more for him it was just sort of stumbling on or working his way toward the right break, which he did eventually get not too long after that, actually, maybe about 6 months when he did link up with Dr. Dre and went on to change history in that way.
Well, I just want to play a little clip here. This is the first track, actually, off the Slim Shady LP, and it's called Public Service Announcement. And in it, you're going to hear the voice of Detroit producer Jeff Bass.
This is a public service announcement brought to you in part by Slim Shady. The views and events expressed here are totally and are not necessarily the views of anyone. However, the events and suggestions that appear on this album are not to be taken lightly. Children should not partake in the listening of this album with laces in their shoes. Slim Shady is not responsible for your actions. Upon purchasing this album, you have agreed not to try this at home.
Anything else?
Yeah. Don't do drugs.
So that's the first track off the Slim Shady LP. It's called Public Service Announcement. I wanted to play that, Brian McCollum, because of Jeff Bass here. You mentioned Dr. Dre, and we'll talk to him about him in just a second. But who was in the inner circle for Eminem in these early years?
Yeah, at that point back in Detroit, it was a pretty tight cadre of folks. It was really Jeff's brother, Mark Bass, who was one of the earliest to kind of latch on to Eminem. He had a manager at the time locally. And of course, his hip hop friends who went on to become part of D12 and other projects. But yeah, the Bass brothers, Jeff's the older one, Mark's the younger, were really his original producers. And they, in fact, that same year that I had met Eminem, had created the Slim Shady EP, which was an independent release that they were trying to get into the hands of as many folks as possible. And they did manage to generate something of an underground buzz. But, you know, at that point, early internet era and whatnot, you know, underground buzz kind of only went so far. But, yeah, and in fact, I should note that Eminem had actually had a previous album called Infinite that really had gone really nowhere back in 95. And the Slim Shady EP was the album where, as I said, he had found his voice and created this, you know, this character, this alter ego, Slim Shady, who went on to become the controversial lightning rod that we associate with Eminem.
Well, so Brian, tell us more about that, right? Because, I mean, when it first burst onto the scene, a lot of people are probably like, who is this guy? I mean, Slim Shady, what was this alter ego? Where did it come from and how did he form it?
Well, famously, the story he tells is that he came up with it while sitting on a toilet. He had, maybe appropriately, when he started out, he was really just kind of imitating other rappers, a lot of the New York guys and whatnot. And he says that the anger that he encountered by being rejected by a lot of folks in the hip-hop community, maybe for being white, this and that, kind of fueled this crazy off-character persona that he created, and thus Slim Shady.
Okay, well, let's listen to a little bit more from the Slim Shady LP from 1999. This is Guilty Conscience, and in this song, Eminem and Dr. Dre are in dueling roles, and Dre is the good conscience, and Eminem the evil one.
He decides to rob a liquor store, but on his way in, he has a sudden change of heart, and suddenly, his conscience comes into play.
All right, stop. Now before you walk in the door to the liquor store and try to get money out the drawer, you better think of the consequence.
Who are you?
I'm a nigga for the conscience.
That's nonsense. Go in,
that's Guilty Conscience from the Slim Shady LP from 1999. Brian McCollum, stand by here for just a second because I want to bring in to the conversation Bakari Kitwana. He's joining us from Cleveland. He's author of Why White Kids Love Hip Hop, and also author of The Hip Hop Generation, Young Blacks and the Crisis in African American Culture, amongst many other books. Bakari Kitwana, welcome to you.
Thank you.
So tell us, from your view, how important or what was the importance of the Slim Shady LP when Eminem released it 20 years ago?
Well, I think that the most important thing was you have this white rapper linking up with Dr. Dre, one of the most important producers in hip hop at the time, with the track record of N.W.A. and Snoop Dogg behind him. And you also have a climate in which hip hop is becoming very broad. It's beginning and it's continuing almost nearly, close to a decade now of platinum sales. And so you have this artist emerge, and it's really kind of odd in that, you know, hip hop is known as a black musical art form. And you have this white guy rapping really well, endorsed pretty much by Dr. Dre. And the hip hop community really already having been introduced to him from the battle rap scene to a unsigned hype column a year before in 98. The Source magazine, where I worked at that time, I was the editor of the Source 95, 96. Continue to work there to create the political affairs department for the next few years. And so a young guy, a high school guy who worked at the magazine, a young aspiring writer, was responsible for digging through this box. It was a refrigerator box, and pulling out these CDs and in many cases still cassettes that people would send in to get reviewed by the Source. And it was a column called Unsigned Hype. And yeah. So Rigoberto Morales was his name, went on to be an A&R for Eminem and continues to work at Atlantic now. And so that was the introduction. But it was shocking. It was kind of shocking. It was unsettling. I think it introduced a lot of baby boomers to hip hop.
No kidding. Well, you know, Bakari and Brian, hang on here for just a second, because we got to take a break here in a minute. And when we come back, I do want to explore more about how and why Dr. Dre wanted or got involved with Eminem, and then also whether or not Eminem, you know, how much race mattered to him and how much he connected back to the earlier days of hip hop. So we've got a lot to explore when we come back. We are talking about the 20th anniversary this week of the Slim Shady LP. It's the LP that put Eminem on the map, for better or for worse. Of course, his career has been very controversial thereafter, but he's also one of the best-known hip-hop superstars around the world. So we're going to take a quick break and go into the break with Role Model. This is, again, from the Slim Shady LP. This is On Point. Drop out of school, people into the city, jump behind the wheel like it was still legal. I'm dumb enough to walk in a store and steal, so I'm dumb enough to ask for a date with Lauryn Hill. Some people only see that I'm white, ignoring skill, because I stand out like a green hat with an orange bill. But I don't get pissed, y'all don't even see through the mist. How to find a clip be white, I don't even exist. I get a clean shave, bathe, go to a rave, die from an old ghost and dig myself up out of my grave. My middle finger won't go down, how do I wave? And this is time I'm supposed to teach kids how to behave.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
Kid who refused to respect adults, wore spectacles with tape frames and a freckled nose. A corny looking white boy, scrawny and always ornery, because I was always sick of brawny bullies picking on me. And I might.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. That is Brain Damage from the Slim Shady LP, first released in 1999 by Eminem. It's the album that really put him on the map as a new rapper and turned him into a global superstar as well. We're joined today by Brian McCollum. He's music writer and critic for the Detroit Free Press, where he's covered music for more than 20 years. Bakari Kidwana also joins us today. He's author of Why White Kids Love Hip-Hop and The Hip-Hop Generation, Young Blacks and the Crisis in African-American Culture. And we want to know what you think. Do you remember when the Slim Shady LP first came out 20 years ago? Was it music that you loved or maybe despised? Brian and Bakari, I just want to play a quick bit of tape here for you. This is a candid video shot by the Bass Brothers in 1999, in which Eminem says that his rapping career thus far was way more difficult than he thought it would be.
I get up in the morning, 7:30, 8 o'clock, get ready, I go get on a plane, get somewhere, go to two or three radio stations, do an in-store, and then do a show, like every night. I always thought, like, you rap, you wear a gold chain, and you drive, and you got a fat crib. That's all I thought.
Yeah.
I didn't realize it, the effort that goes into it.
It's Eminem in 1999. Bakari Kitwana, actually, let me turn to you first. You know, when I hear Eminem saying, I didn't realize all the effort that goes into it, it seems kind of weird to me, because if he had known, genuinely known anything about hip-hop and its history, he ought to know that it's been all effort from the beginning.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, listening to that. You know, Eminem started rapping when he was 14. The Slim Shady album doesn't come out until he's 27. So he had already been working at this for a while. You know, just thinking about, you know, those hip hop origin stories, his later on kind of documented in the film 8 Mile. There's a really interesting and fascinating book on the life of DMX. And it's called Earl, the Autobiography. And he's talking about what he was doing leading up to his rap career. And he was often, he documents himself as a stick-up kid for the most part. And he's doing this right up till, I mean, he has an album almost out. So the struggle in hip-hop, you know and the struggle for the generation in terms of young people, you know, looking for work and struggling without education. Eminem repeated the ninth grade 3 times before dropping out of high school. He worked a series of odd jobs that he hated. And so I think, yeah, if in those days you saw hip hop on TV, you saw hip hop in music videos, and you thought, yeah, I'm going to be a rapper and I'm going to be successful. So I could see how he could have that take on it. I mean, but at the same time, you just had Lauryn Hill win 5 Grammys
right.
The year before. Mm-hmm. For The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. You had DMX, wildly successful at the time with a popular album, Outkast, wildly successful. And so this was the context in which he kind of emerges.
Mm. So, Brian, let me turn back to you here, because in your in your oral history of the Slim Shady LP, it's really interesting, because you talk about, the oral history describes how it was really hard for Eminem to get signed on a major record label here, in part because he was white.
Yeah, I mean, at that point, late 90s, the stigma of Vanilla Ice kind of loomed over everything. Yeah. Still, as Bakari pointed out, yeah, that unsigned hype column did him a lot of good, because it kind of legitimized him in a way, I think, that really cleared that path. You know, there was definitely buzz building by the time the cassette got into the hands of Dr. Dre, and I think it was February of 98. But at that point, Eminem and the people around him have basically said that was our last shot. That trip out to California a few months earlier for the Rap Olympics, which was a rap battle competition, like if nothing came out of this, that might be it. At least that's how they tell it in retrospect.
Right. I mean, I'm looking at a point. Sorry to jump in here, but sure. I'm looking at a part of the oral history, and someone says that that they were trying to get the tape or the material around to everyone at Loud, at Def Jam, all the labels that you could think of that were selling rap. But everybody, quote, everybody liked it, but was scared to make a move on it. Why was that?
I think in part because of the white rap stigma.
Yeah. Okay.
Credit to Dr. Dre for recognizing the talent when it was put in front of him. I actually talked to the kid, well, he was a kid then, who was on the lowest rungs at Interscope, who had seen Eminem at the Rap Olympics, was fascinated, asked for a tape, got it, and spent 5 months trying to get it into the hands of Jimmy Iovine, the head of Interscope, which Dr. Dre's Aftermath label is affiliated with. And, sort of the right circumstances unfolded from there once and very quickly, in fact. Dre and Jimmy Iovine sat down, heard this tape. Dre was blown away. And, within a couple days, they were all sitting together in an office crafting a record deal.
Yeah. Well, we've got a lot of callers who want to join us, so let's go to them quickly. Let's go to Gabby, who's calling from Norfolk, Virginia. Gabby, you're on the air.
Hi.
Go ahead, Gabby. Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yes, I just wanted to say that I jumped into Slim Shady on his Curtain Call album, and as a kid whose parents are drug addicts, you know, it really helped me understand my anger, my hurt, and my pain, and it really helped me through. So kudos to Eminem. I'm so happy that I had him as an influence, and I'm happy for his success. That's all I have to say.
Well, Gabby, thank you so much for your call. Bakari Kitwana, we have a very similar comment here on Facebook from Emily Bowling Berry, who says, I love how Eminem speaks to the pain, fear, and anxiety we all experience. That said, his music is for mature audiences only, and I don't listen to him when my kids are around. When they're older, I'll be proud to introduce them to his music and messages. So what do you hear in the fact that lots of his fans said that they reached him in a way that other artists hadn't?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was an there's definitely some truth to that. I think many artists rap about their personal experiences. I think that Eminem at the time, you know, was almost like a Jerry Springer meets Michael Myers experience. He was anti-family values. He was anti-gay. He was anti-government. And, you know, I think that his lyrics were, you know, represented an honesty that he saw things happening in his life. And some of that stuff had to do with, you know, some of the things that the caller talked about. And I think people identify with it. I think similarly, more recently, you have other folks now saying the same similar things about Kendrick Lamar.
Yeah.
when he emerged, you know, just this kind of a sense of young people feeling alienated and him kind of tapping into that. But I think one of the powerful things about what Eminem did was he emerged as a great lyricist. And you even had people like Rakim, who is known as one of the best lyricists ever, you know, talking often about why he thought Eminem was a great rapper and why he was a great lyricist, and, you know, getting those type of endorsements from within the hip hop community, and then really getting a lot of love outside of the hip hop community with the new audiences that were drawn into hip hop.
Right.
Which made it unsettling a little bit, because you had really this almost like wild overnight success. This is his first album on a major record label, and it sells through the roof. And then the next year they put out another one that sells through the roof, and he won 2 Grammys for this,
right,
you know, for a first album. So it was such a huge shift, and I think race did play a huge part.
Well, yeah. So, okay. So this is what I want to just dig into for just a second. And Brian, let me turn back to you on this, because,
sure,
you know, I read that the comment from Facebook, and we had the caller call in saying, like, you know, just he spoke to the particular pain I was feeling and the anger, and like gave like a musical outlet for that. But in, you know, in truth, obviously Eminem wasn't the first hip hop artist to do that. Like, hip hop from its start spoke to challenges and pain and conditions in life that African Americans had been experiencing for a while. I mean, is what we're saying here is that he basically was able to take that same throbbing heart of hip hop and serve it up to white audiences because he was white. So he's talking about, I don't know, how do I say this? White pain. Can I say that? I'm not even sure I can say that. But do you see what I'm getting at?
I think he would say it. He's certainly, you know, throughout his career, he's acknowledged in really emphatic ways this context you're talking about him as a white guy operating in what had been traditionally and largely still an African-American art form. And he was self-deprecating about it. He was honest about it. He had a song called White America in 2002 that actually almost kind of accused the culture for uplifting him to the levels that he attained. Like, you know, he essentially said, my sales are double what they would have been if I'd been anyone else in hip hop. So I don't think that's an unfair way to characterize it. And again, I think he'd agree with you as well.
Because,
I do. I mean, I think lyrically, it's always interesting to point out that there were really kind of 3 voices he had. One was Marshall Mathers, which was the kind of introspective, personal rapper. There was Eminem, who was kind of the hip hop artiste and lyricist, and then Slim Shady was the the persona, this crazy, he even adopted a different voice for it, like this higher pitched delivery. And that's where all that rage and anger that I think was real inside him got channeled into this fictionalized character with these over the top scenarios, you know, which was interesting. Definitely captured real aspects of his personality, like his mischievousness. He was a prankster in real life. The real Marshall Mathers had a quick temper. Slim Shady had a quick temper. So it was this odd blurring of fiction and reality.
Right. So, Bakari, let me get your take on this here, because I'm not putting any shade on Eminem's talent, right, and his lyricism and his uniqueness in that moment. I mean, obviously that was all there. I guess what I'm trying to get at or wonder about is, oh, well, more audiences, more white audiences were willing to listen to him when the very same messages and spirit had always been in hip hop.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that Eminem rapped about the experiences that came out of his own life.
Yeah.
I think that the audience attraction to him, it was pretty overwhelming. The popularity was overwhelming, and it still is. I mean, Eminem tours, you know, he was in Italy over the summer, and, you know, you had artists infinitely more influential in hip hop. I won't say their names, right? Opening for him. You know what I mean? So I think that because it's one album, right? It's the first album. It's wildly successful. I feel like people who had been in hip hop, who saw other artists who had longer careers, who had been at it longer, I think that there was a lot of tension around the race question. And, you know, also you had a history of this conversation, I think beginning in 1992, around this statistic that was created saying that white kids were hip hop's primary audience. You know, this was never statistically, there was never a study actually done to prove this, but this became like, you know, a known fact in hip hop, right? And so then you get this white rapper and the thing goes through the roof, which to me kind of begs the question, you know, well, where were these folks before, right?
Yeah. All right, well, let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Jacques, who's calling from Los Angeles. Jacques, you're on the air.
Hey, guys. I think, like a great athlete, a great musician is measured by how much they changed their music or how much they changed, you know, their music. And that album was really a turning point. It's you know, probably you can point to one of, like, you know, a top five, at least a top 10 moment, because it launched a whole different genre of, like, rap. You don't have bands like, you know, Limp Bizkit coming out, which might have been a good thing. But he did. He completely changed the landscape for a whole different kind of audience. And, you know, it was a connecting point, and it is. It's one of the most important albums to come out of that era, because it did bridge a gap between a lot of different, you know, communities. I luckily got to work on maybe 20 different video projects through Eminem and his empire through the band D12 and stuff like that. So I got to work with a lot of people at Interscope Records who owe their entire careers to that album. It truly was a king-making moment.
Well, Jacques, thank you so much for your call. Brian McCollum, I'm fascinated by Jacques saying, well, first of all, he's worked with Eminem on a bunch of video projects, but that he credits Eminem with launching an entire genre. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's one way to put it, I guess. As Bakari alluded to a minute ago, I think there are rappers who, you know, hip hop people consider more influential in the grand scheme of things.
Right.
I think Eminem's influence is more cultural in bringing in this broader white audience. And I mean, certainly had a distinctive sound. I don't mean to downplay that. You know, in fact, we were talking about the Bass Brothers earlier. One of their signatures on the Slim Shady LP was they didn't do any sampling, which of course was this intrinsic part of the hip hop tradition. They used live instruments to create these sounds that sounded like samples. I certainly want to say that they started this phenomenon by any means, but I think they at least foreshadowed this trend in hip hop that through the years would move away from sampling to some extent. So, you know, there's some musical influence for you, but I think it really was more than just style. It was this broader phenomenon that Eminem ignited.
Bakar, we've got about a minute to go before we take a break here. What do you think about that?
I mean, I think that, you know, a little... I think we should go back more, you know, because I feel like in terms of hip hop really crossing over, I think that we started to see that earlier with folks like Snoop, with folks like Tupac, and, you know, a lot of folks really gravitating to hip hop across race before this. But I think that what we saw with this moment was more of an American phenomenon. And the question for black hip hop audiences were, is he more talented than black rappers? And the answer was no. Was he the Elvis of hip hop? Was he stealing sales from black artists because he was white? And I think that these are all, you know, these are all valid questions.
Wow. Well, Bakari Kitwana and Brian McCollum, stand by here for just a second. We are talking about the 20th anniversary of the Slim Shady LP. It's the record that put Eminem on the map as one of the biggest global stars in rap. And we're going to take a quick break here with If I Had from the LP. Again, came out first in 1999. We'll be right back. This is On Point. I'd still be out robbing armored trucks. If I had one wish, I would ask for a big enough ass for the world to kiss. I'm tired of being white trash, broken, always poor. Tired of taking pop bottles back to the party store. Tired of not having the phone. Tired of not having a home to have one in. If I did have one on. Tired of not driving a BM. Tired of not working at GM. Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. That is Eminem in his 2002 album, The Eminem Show. The track is White America. And this hour, we're talking about the 20th anniversary of the album that really put Eminem on the map, the Slim Shady LP. It turns 20 this week. Hard to believe it was released all the way back in 1999. Do you remember the first release of the Slim Shady LP? What did you hear when Eminem burst onto the world stage as one of the most talented rappers, at least the super talented white rapper that changed the face of hip-hop for at least quite a while? Obviously, Eminem has courted controversy from the beginnings, I should say, of his career. I want to play a moment from a 2000 congressional hearing where members of Congress were listening to testimony on children's entertainment and violence. And in one of those hearings, Liz Cheney, wife of Vice President Dick Cheney, really singled out Eminem.
He is a violent misogynist. He advocates raping and murdering his mother in one of his songs. He glories in the same song in the idea that he might murder any woman he comes across.
That's Liz Cheney in 2000 holding up Eminem as an example of the worst of American entertainment. Let's go to Colleen, who's calling from Mount Clemens, Michigan. Colleen, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. When the Slim Shady LP first came out, I was a 20-year-old college feminist, you know, immersed in that campus culture, and I was absolutely horrified by the misogyny of it. My brother was one of those white kids that, you know, hip-hop scene and loved Eminem. Every time we got in the car, he was putting on the Slim Shady LP. 20 years later, my brother never gave up playing Eminem for me, and as he evolved as an artist and I grew as a person, I'm a huge fan. I love looking back at those old albums for what they were. not necessarily what I thought of them at the time.
Okay, so Colleen, can I ask you, I mean, what do you think changed? Because I want to say I feel very familiar with a lot of what you're saying. When the album first came out for me, I had a real hard time with it. I want to be honest. Like, the misogyny in some of the tracks, I could not listen to it. I'm not sure my opinion on that has changed in particular all that much, but I do recognize much more of his talent and artistry now. But so, like, what do you think changed for you?
I think it's that when the album first came out, this is what we knew Eminem as. I mean, even growing up in suburban Detroit, and my brother was somewhat aware of him on the underground scene, Slim Shady was what we knew. Looking back now, and you see the nuances between Marshall Mathers and then that Slim Shady character that he put on in that early album.
All right. Well, Colleen, thank you so much for your call. Brian McCollum, what do you think about what Colleen said?
Yeah, it's interesting. And you just had said a few minutes ago that it doesn't feel like 20 years in a certain yeah. way. But in another sense, it feels like a whole universe ago, you know, like that period, that kind of shock jock era, and that there would be congressional hearings about graphic lyrics and whatnot. But it's funny because he's still getting a lot of criticism these days, but it's in a different form somehow. The culture has changed. He's I don't know what would happen if somebody tried to put out a Slim Shady LP in 2019. I don't know how. I'm not sure how it would be received or if it would have it would be able to get that same momentum. You know, he released an album last summer, Kamikaze, that a lot of people sort of think of as his most Slim Shadiest album in quite a while, and it did really well. But it was interesting, the some of the backlash against a gay slur that was in one of the songs came. It was more widespread in this instance. Some of the one of the musicians involved disowned the song in this case. Some big name artists came out against it. So it's kind of interesting how that shifted over 20 years.
Yeah. Bakari Kitwana, your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think those are all really valid points. I mean, and to the caller's point, I mean, I don't think that the misogyny can really be understated. One of the things about hip hop is, you know, people have always had this kind of accusation of 90s, 80s, late 80s, early 90s through the 90s hip hop as kind of being misogynistic. But this was even extreme in a different kind of way. And it was very violent even. And, you know, but under the auspices of being an alter ego, you know, people seem to not react as strongly to it. I think the climate has radically shifted. You had the congressional hearings, you know, you said it was 2000. This is a transition between the Clinton years and the Bush years. And so, you know, the Republican Party and conservatives were really advancing this notion of anti-family values. Talk about the shifts. I mean, you almost got a Slim Shady president, right? you also got young people really kind of shifting their energy, and this generation of young people being much more outspoken about, you know, anti-gay attacks and heightening the language around intersectionality and analysis of gender politics. And so I feel like, no, I don't think that. I mean, if people are going to go back and dig up a comedian's comments on Twitter, you know, and, yeah, and that causes this huge backlash. Absolutely. I think there's going to be a backlash to an artist coming out with this type of music today.
Yeah. Well, we've got lots of comments here coming in online. Z-Cause says, love it or hate it, you can't deny the album's worldwide notoriety. You could find old English D Tiger hats in all the big European clothing stores next to the NY Yankee hats. That was all Eminem. Mallory Pacheco says, I was 12 or 13 years old when I first heard the album as a young girl from a boring white bread suburb. It scared me. I had no idea what he's talking about, but his music grew on me as his career continued. And looking back now, I think he truly speaks to many disillusioned people. Let's go to Corey, who's calling from Orange, Connecticut. Corey, you're on the air.
Hey, guys. Thank you so much for taking my call. I just wanted to call and say that, I mean, I was probably about 9 or 10 years old when the album first came out. And there was something about the cartoonish quality, the character that was Slim Shady, that kind of spoke to me and some of my friends, and it always kind of seemed like a joke. I mean, we didn't take the way that he spoke and even the anger just seemed like it was all a persona that he was putting on. Mm-hmm. I mean, before him, before him, we had people like Fred Durst. We had the Beastie Boys. And I mean, you know, we had, you know, the House of Pain. We didn't have anybody who was lyrically inclined and who had the vocabulary that he did to kind of to put on this show. And then I just found it so funny how people overreacted to it. I mean, there were congressional hearings about a rapper. He was just, they were just words. And but they did shape, you know, I have to say, they did shape the way that I grew up, the way that I spoke, my sense of humor. I mean, it was a seminal album for me. It has aged incredibly well. I think it speaks well. Now you're either on one side, you're either, you know, based on the political landscape or whatever you want to call it these days, you're on one side of the fence or the other. You are either seeing these things as a joke and taking these topics lightly, or you're completely outspoken against them.
Right. Well, Corey, thank you so much for your call. I obviously hear that it was, as you said, a seminal album in your life. So let's hear from some other folks as well. Let's go to Brandon, who's calling from Norfolk, Virginia. Brandon, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. I was about 11 or 12. I just realized that when we were on the air, when I was listening to you on the air, that when this album came out. And what strikes me is that my father, whenever I listened to music, bought a CD. He would get home from work. He would take the CD, pop it into my CD player, and sit on the chair in the living room and listen to the album through. Now I always thought he was taking a nap. Maybe he was, but he would finish the album and he would give it back to me. And this time, I mean, I was just sure after hearing "Hi, My Name Is" on the radio. I mean, I was blasted. I had to get the album, and I was sure that he wasn't going to let me listen to it. And he handed it back to me, and I was very excited. And I went and listened to it, and I was like, "Wow!" He handed it back to me. Now, as an 11 or 12 year old black kid, I'm from Charlotte, North Carolina. I went to a mixed high school, and I was already aware of, you know, all of my friends that are different races. They all had an interest in rap, so I thought that the album was going to, you know, be received well by all, and it pretty much was. Now, as I get older, like my wife, she hates listening to Eminem. Now, she grew up in a different environment. She just does not like his tone of voice. She doesn't like his attacks on women, or he's talking about killing people and these sadistic ways and taking all these different drugs. She doesn't like it. And I think it just stems from, you know, her being like a more traditional rap, hip hop person, an R&B type person. And well, me being more of like listening to everything.
Well, Brandon, I actually want to take it back from you there. And thank you so much for your call. Bakari Kitwana, Brandon's story is absolutely fascinating to me, right? Like, I just, especially him saying that he immediately detected the crossover appeal here and was right with his friends of any race growing up. What do you think about that?
I mean, I think a part of the crossover appeal, also, I think it requires some of an understanding of hip hop. And in that, I mean, you know, as a brilliant lyricist, you know, people in hip hop who focus on that aspect can often overlook other things like misogyny. So that was something, plus the fact that he was, you know, produced by Dr. Dre. Those were two, you know, important ingredients. The other thing that I think is interesting, and this is something that Eminem continues to come back to as a theme in his own music, and it continues to resonate with him now. I think the fact that he underestimated the extent to which his whiteness would play a role in his success, that continues to plague him. It's something that really bothered him. I mean, he had a crew, you know, that he ran with in Detroit, and, you know, it wasn't a group of white kids. You know, we had had other groups of white MCs, right? Crews of white MCs, but this wasn't that. This was someone who wanted to immerse themselves in a black cultural art form as a white person, doing something that he loved. And he wanted to do it in the way that he did it, but race still played a role and he couldn't control it.
Well, you know what? Speaking of that, I want to fast forward here in time a little bit and play something for both of you from 2016. This is from The Fader, a music and culture magazine. They interviewed Mac Miller, and Miller was an acclaimed white rapper who died of a drug overdose just last fall. He was just 26 years old. But here, Mac Miller, again, this is 2016, he talks about race.
I think I get a benefit from being white. I think that white kids can see me and see themselves like, I could be me. So, I mean, I think that was a huge boost for me. And a guilty thing when I was coming up, like, oh, am I only here because I'm white? Is that the only reason? So, yeah, I think I had to prove to myself that I was more than just a white guy that is lucky because he's white.
That's Mac Miller from 2016. Brian McCollum, you know, I want to spend the last couple of minutes with you and Bakari talking about the long-term legacy of the Slim Shady LP. And it is one of them that after this album came out and after Eminem really became this huge global breakout star, that next generation white rappers didn't necessarily have to, you know, think back and get an education in the totality of hip-hop history, that for them it could start with Eminem and the new space he created.
Yeah, that's possible. I mean, he opened a lot of eyes. I think what you just played from Mac Miller there in, what'd you say, 2016,
yeah,
kind of sounded like Eminem 10 years earlier, so sort of conveying those same sentiments. So, yeah, I don't think that's unfair at all. I mean, there have been some smart pieces written in recent years about whether the latest crop of white rappers is truly cognizant of that the world they're operating there in hip hop in the same way that Eminem was in a pretty authentic way early on in his career.
Bakari, what's your thought about that?
I think that there is increasingly little concern. I mean, and it's fascinating because we're in the most America's more racially polarized at any point probably since the 60s. And yeah, I think that if an artist, you know, emerges who's white, there's going to be a lot, there's going to be more of a critique. I mean, I think Macklemore is another good recent example. Ironically, I interview Macklemore in the introduction for Why White Kids Love Hip Hop. He had not yet been signed at that point. And he really, in the interview, he really talks about his struggles with race more so from white people who were like, dude, why are you rapping? Like, that's something black people do. Like, you're not black, you know, be yourself. And his response was, I'm being myself. This is what I like. This is what I do. And I feel like as he became more popular, that type of introspective analysis about race became less outspoken for him. So it's just interesting the impact that the fans have and the impact that race has in America, not only for a white rapper, but for even black rappers. There's this constant presence in which race is present in the analysis, in the visual perception, in the preconceived notions of who young black people are and women. I think you see it also with Cardi B in different ways.
Right. You know, we've just got a minute left to go. And Brian, I want to kind of come full circle with you here because you are there in Detroit, and that is the city that helped create Eminem. And I didn't ask you at the beginning, and I should have. You know, how much of a role does Detroit and its sound or sounds play here in helping put Eminem like into the stratosphere in terms of stardom?
A pretty big one, actually, I think. You know, there's this long history in Detroit music. There's a certain stream, I should say, or a certain strain going back decades of this kind of over-the-top, you know, provocative, off-kilter, most deranged guy on the block, and with a touch of theatrical. Like, you could go back to, you know, like an Iggy Pop. This is the city that produced Alice Cooper. You had Ted Nugent, the Motor City Madman. You know, this is the city that embraced Kiss. The Slim Shady LP was like the biggest manifestation of that imagery and that theme, this kind of graphic, cartoony, over-the-top stuff. Absolutely.
Well, Brian McCollum, music writer and critic for the Detroit Free Press. We have a link to his piece, Eminem Slim Shady LP Turns 20. It's an oral history and it's terrific. It's at onpointradio.org. Brian, thank you so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And Bakari Kitwana, author of Why White Kids Love Hip Hop and director of Rap Sessions, Community Dialogues on Hip Hop, a national tour of town hall style meetings for young people. Bakari Kitwana, it's been a great pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Folks, keep your comments and thoughts coming about Slim Shady turning 20. Go to onpointradio.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.